you very much, Eric. I hope I can get through all this in 1 hour. Astronomy is very much an art or a science of exploration. It's been an attempt to explore the universe, and it attempts to discover what the contents of the universe are and something about the physical processes which are associated with the things we see. Now, it certainly won't be possible to travel outside the solar system in our generation or in any generation which is foreseeable. And consequently, this exploration is very much something which goes on in the mind. And the mind is fed by observations, facts, and we attempt to interpret these in terms of the universe as a whole. Now, I'd like to be quite clear that there have certainly been golden ages of astronomy in the past, when many minds have been preoccupied with the problems of astronomy. But the current age for astronomers has been particularly exciting because in the last 20 years we've had at our disposal unprecedented instruments, both in their quality and quantity. There have been large telescopes on the Earth, radio telescopes, optical telescopes, satellites in orbit, spacecraft which have gone to other planets, particle detectors, and in addition, that very useful tool, the electronic computer, which has helped us to digest all of this information. This has all led to some very exciting discoveries, and I want to try and touch on a very few of these this evening to try and pass on some of this excitement to you. Historically, I have the feeling that this is perhaps the most important thing to have happened in astronomy in the last decade. Historically, because I think millions of people have suddenly come to realize what we mean when we say the planet Earth and what our position is in space. This is one of the many views taken of the planet Earth by the Apollo's astronauts. Now, we have traveled to some of the nearer planets, and I would like to go quickly through some of the slides which relate to our observations of those. This very briefly outlines the position of the planets in the solar system. As you probably know, there are 9 planets, 8 of them shown here. The Sun is indicated at the center here. Mercury is closest to the Sun, then Venus, our Earth, Mars, the asteroid belt, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which are the giant planets, and outside, generally, Pluto, which is a small planet like the inner ones. When we go to... Let's consider first Mercury. This is a shot taken from the Mariner 10 spacecraft in 1974. And reveals what we probably had expected, that Mercury looks very similar to the Moon. This is a mosaic of several photographs put together. You can see where the photographs have been added together and matched. And we see a surface which is dominated by craters, lava flow, and some of these craters here, the largest, are about 200 kilometers in diameter. Mercury, in fact, resembles the Moon in being similar in size, but in a very important way is different. We strongly believe that the center of the planet is liquid, rather like the center of our Earth. It has a molten core because we detect a magnetic field, and the surface shows signs of shrinkage that is shrinkage due to the interior, which has caused some crinkling in the surface. Here's a close-up shot and shows evidence of lava flow in this old crater. And we're looking at craters which may be down to a size of about 1 kilometer in diameter. In this scene, which was probably the one taken at closest approach, we see a shallow scalloped cliff here, which is typical of the surface of Mercury and is a result of this shrinkage of the core, or it is suggested that that's what it's due to. So Mercury appears to be a cross between our own moon and the Earth. Early in its mission, Mariner 10 flew by the planet Venus. Venus is no goddess of love, as far as we're concerned, and it's certainly the ugly twin sister of the Earth. It's a very unfortunate place. The atmosphere of Venus is extremely thick and high and consists almost entirely of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. The surface temperature on the planet is about 500 degrees centigrade with an atmospheric pressure of about 90 atmospheres, Earth atmospheres. That's the equivalent of being under about 3,000 feet of water. In addition to this, it has further charms. There is almost certainly a significant quantity of sulfuric and hydrochloric acids which fall as a rain on the surface. Under these circumstances, one can only applaud the fact that the Russians were not only able to land one of their probes on the surface of the moon, but that it operated for almost a full hour in taking photographs. I don't have any of those photographs, unfortunately, since I only had available to me what everybody else had in the newspapers. This certainly is probably the most corrosive place in the solar system. This photograph was taken in ultraviolet light and shows something of the cloud structure which shows up when we photograph the planet in ultraviolet light, a circulation in which wind velocities may reach as much as 300 kilometers per hour, and a Y-shaped distortion in which equatorial winds circulate towards the poles. I doubt if we'll see anybody land on that in our lifetime. Mars, of course, has a great emotional appeal. Here is one of the best ground-based photographs, which is actually a composite of several. Mars, which is some 6,700 kilometers in diameter, one displays seasonal changes in its polar caps and shows vague, dusty markings, some of which appear to change in time. And it's always been thought that this may be the one place in our solar system where life, at least in a very primitive form, similar to that on Earth, might exist. Now, if you look at this area here, which is just only vaguely defined in ground-based photographs, we can consider that as it was revealed by the Mariner 9 satellite, which went into orbit around Mars and took a vast number of photographs. This is a mosaic of several hundred photographs and spans about one-third of the planet, of the planet's circumference. Now, what one sees, if they look a little carefully, and I'll try to delineate these features, you can see all the various photographs which have been put together, is a canyon system which extends right across the photograph. And this canyon system is extremely modulated. It is about 4,000 kilometers long, about 6 kilometers deep, and about 100 kilometers across at the top. That is something like 3 or 4 times the depth of the Grand Canyon and considerably greater in extent. It would stretch, say, from Vancouver to Montreal. In addition, we find a large number of volcanoes. Some 9 volcanoes have been discovered, crustal volcanoes, in various, generally in this area up here. There's 1, 2, and a particularly large one, Olympus Mons, which I'll show you in more detail in a moment. Let's consider the canyon system for a moment. Here is a section through one of the deepest parts of the canyon, taken along this dotted line here. The canyon is running in this sense, as you can see, well defined here now. And here is a side canyon with several parts to it. When we consider the section, it's shown at the bottom here. The horizontal scale is in miles. The vertical scale is both in miles and kilometers. And it was possible, by other measurements from the orbiting satellite, to measure these heights. And here you see a 6-kilometer depth, or nearly 20,000 feet to the bottom of the canyon, and a variety of other depths. Now, it's quite possible that fracturing in the surface coupled with wind erosion has been sufficient to cause what we see here. On the other hand, there are suggestions that there has been water erosion, which occurs on the surface of the Earth. But although, again, the atmosphere of Mars, like Venus, consists almost entirely of carbon dioxide, the atmospheric pressure is only 1/100th that on Earth. It's a very, very tenuous atmosphere. There's very little of it. But this doesn't prevent there being severe storms. Here's a time sequence of the same area of Mars, showing the development and subsequent result of a violent dust storm. In each photograph, it doesn't seem very bright to me, I hope it's brighter for you, a particular crater is identified, and the arrow points to the same crater in each picture. It's just displaced. The photograph is taken in a slightly different position. In the first photograph, a storm is developing over here, a dust storm, which has become quite violent and extensive. It's some 400 or 500 kilometers in extent down here. And this is just the following day. 2 weeks later, another storm is beginning again over to the left here. But the area which was subject to the storm originally has now turned significantly darker than it was in the earlier stage. And this is very suggestive of a wind erosion in which the upper loose material has been blown away and we're seeing the darker rock underneath. However, there are certainly some puzzles and some great challenge is presented by a picture like this, where we see something which is completely reminiscent of a sinuous valley on the surface of the Earth, which certainly must have been caused by some liquid, more fluid than lava, and the natural choice, of course, is water. Whether there is subsurface water which has been released is not clear, because certainly there isn't enough atmospheric water at the moment. Now, this picture presents a problem in perspective, at least it does for me. Maybe some of you have no problem. This is the monstrous volcano, Olympus Mons, which is 25 kilometers high, about 600 kilometers in diameter at the base. And the perspective problem that I find is recognizing that this is the highest point here. The whole thing doesn't form a crater, but there's in fact a peak. This is a cliff on the edge, and this is the caldera in the center. These cliffs around here, the lava cliffs surrounding it, reach a height of about 2 kilometers. And this diameter here is about, as I say, 600. If we compare it with the largest similar volcano on Earth, which is Mauna Kea, by coincidence, that's about 9 kilometers above the seabed. This is just a very small part of what has been seen on the surface of Mars. Already the Viking has been launched towards Mars, and this is a satellite plus lander which will attempt to find out whether there are organisms on Mars, that is, or life forms. This is an artist's conception of the lander once it is on the moon, and it should be there sometime in July or August of next year. There will be a boom, at the end of which is a scoop, which will collect material, which will be transferred into a series of 3 so-called biological laboratories, which will check for metabolism, uptake of nutrients, and gas transfer and so forth, the various standard tests for life forms. There are also cameras on board which will survey the landscape. That's perhaps a little clearer, and maybe you can pick out one or two things of interest to you. We see that there will be a meteorological experiment on board, of course, to measure all of the standard items such as wind velocity, direction, etc., and standard telemetry. So perhaps by this time next year, there may or may not be some very exciting evidence for the biologists to consider. Pioneer 11, in December of 1974, began to send back the first near pictures of the planet Jupiter. Jupiter is the first of the giant planets. It's more massive than all of the other planets put together. It also emits 2 to 3 times as much radiation as it actually receives from the sun. Therefore, it's a source of heat. It has a magnetic field, an extremely powerful magnetic field. It's a strong radio source, and it rotates very rapidly in about 9 hours. And its composition, because it's so massive, it's been able to retain all of its hydrogen, is very similar to that of the Sun. So together with its 13 or so satellites, it really is more like a cold star than a terrestrial planet. This view shows the cloud belts, which of course we've been able to see from Earth. It also shows a small amount of structure around the edge where these cloud belts intersect the horizon. And here is a close-up, or the closest view obtained, of the red spot, which was a famous feature which has been viewed for, I think, something like 200 years, and is now quite clearly a storm, a very persistent storm. We have seen other storms of this sort, smaller in size, which have come and gone, and this spot tends to move around, a cyclonic type of storm. Perhaps I should say something about what we think the atmosphere and Jupiter itself, the particular structure. The main component is hydrogen, and the atmosphere which we can see, it's probably the upper layers of hydrogen, and immediately below that are ammonia crystals, and then probably some ice and crystals and some water in lower layers, before we reach the surface, which is probably a slush or liquid hydrogen, And the very center may in fact be a particular form of hydrogen which is somewhat metallic, and it's just possible the very center may be metallic like the center of our own Earth. This is a view showing something of the North Pole, something which is quite impossible to photograph from our own Earth, of course. You see the red spot here, the cloud belts, and in this area, a convection zone, which is shows convection cells, which are not too dissimilar from the thunderclouds, which we see in our own Earth, or at least so they are thought to be. There's a considerably greater amount of detail, which is not available to me, and which, of course, is currently being analyzed. Pioneer 11 has swung on, and it will get to the region of Saturn by September of 1979. And this is a ground-based photograph, of course, and we can expect, perhaps, to learn something more, particularly about the composition of the very beautiful rings which surround Saturn. Let's consider the Sun now for a moment, our own Sun. This is a photograph taken in an emission line of hydrogen, that is, hydrogen is the main component of the Sun. And I ask you just to not to bother about this ghost-like photograph over here, that's just an artifact of the way we take the photograph. There's no energy crisis as far as the Sun is concerned. The Sun puts out enough energy in 1 second to match the needs of mankind for the next million years. In fact, if I could try to put it into mass energy terms, I've attempted to do this, you're probably aware that Einstein was one of the first to show that matter and energy are interconvertible, and that one can equate a certain amount of energy with a certain amount of mass. Then the Sun is converting 4 million tons per second of its mass into energy, or if you like, it's getting lighter at that rate as matter is lost through radiation. I use this analogy because I want to refer back to this later when we consider some of the very energetic sources in the galaxy. Mankind's use of energy represents a fraction of a gram per second, or perhaps, if you like, the dripping of a tap. It's about the rate at which we turn mass into energy as a whole. Perhaps a useful analogy for those who would like to see it that way, I consider that the Sun is consuming the equivalent of one Olympic stadium per second. The energy production we had always considered came from the conversion of hydrogen into helium, nuclear reactions at the center. We can't, of course, see the center here, but there are very compelling arguments to assume that the center is at a very high pressure and temperature, and under conditions which would favor nuclear reactions and the production of energy. One offshoot of this would be the production of elementary particles called neutrinos, which have a almost vanishing interaction with other matter. As a result, neutrinos, an enormous flux of which should be passing through this room at the moment, should escape from the center of the Sun, pass through it with very little attenuation, and reach the Earth. Unfortunately, very careful attempts to detect these neutrinos have failed at the surface of the Earth, and the accumulating statistics are becoming extremely embarrassing. And it may be either that the experiment is wrong, or that our whole concept of the internal structure of the stars will require some revision. Let me give you some idea of the scale of the universe as I want to discuss it, or the scale on which we have to operate. The sun is about 1.5 million kilometers in diameter. And if we define the unit of distance as the time of flight of light, then light would take about 5 seconds to travel across the diameter of the sun. Light the sun emits takes about 8 minutes to reach us here on Earth, and to get to the edge of the solar system would take about 4 hours. That is out to the orbit of Neptune and Pluto, take about 4 hours. But to our nearest star, neighbor, it would take about 4 years. So that any information we gain from the nearest stars has already been traveling to us for several years. And this is a somewhat random area in the sky showing the large variety of colors and distribution of stars. You have to consider that all of these stars are separated by many light years. If we consider on this picture, which is a picture of another galaxy, but which our own galaxy probably resembles, the stars in our galaxy are gathered into a system which is probably about 70 to 100 light year, 100,000 light years across. From here to here, light would take something like 70 to 100,000 years to traverse this distance. Our sun is situated well out towards one edge, and the galaxy as a whole contains something like 10,000 million stars. But we can see other galaxies, and in fact we can think we can see as many as 100 million other galaxies, all of which contain possibly as many or a maximum, perhaps, of 10,000 million stars each. This is a photograph of a cluster of galaxies, Coma Cluster. And the galaxies in our own neighborhood and the average separation of galaxies is something of the order of a million light years. That is, light would take something of the order of a million years to travel between any two galaxies in this group. So if you like to think of it in a different fashion, the light which was used in making this exposure was traveling to us and started out some hundreds of millions of years ago, in many of cases, long before man ever set foot on the Earth. Now, the important or very interesting situation which was discovered many years ago is that the galaxies are moving away from each other. That is, the universe appears to be expanding. And this is a point which I may return to a little later on. In addition, radio astronomers discovered that a large number of galaxies emit a great deal of radio noise. They're extremely energetic at radio frequencies. Here, for example, is the radio galaxy Centaurus A, in which here is the optical image of the galaxy. You have to shrink this down and put it over here in this little square. And when the radio astronomers look at this region, they find something which is extremely bright and extended. In fact, it is in two parts on either side of the galaxy. These are contours which indicate if you like, something similar to height on the ground. The higher, the larger the numbers here, the brighter it is. And a large number of radio galaxies of this form have been discovered, with two large blobs on either side, things which are invisible in on visible photographs, but which are extremely bright radio frequencies. And it seemed clear that the central galaxy itself had thrown this material out, possibly in some sort of explosion. And there's become an increasing preoccupation with what may happen in the very centers of galaxies. There may be extremely energetic events taking place. If we consider the nearest major galaxy to ourselves, the one in Andromeda, which probably looks rather like the galaxy we live in, that is, it has spirals and a central concentration of stars. These are two dwarf galaxies which are associated with it. And if we look right at the very center of it, as you see in this next slide, we detect something which looks rather like a star, but is in fact it has a finite extent in our photographs. This we call the nucleus. And it appears that many galaxies have such nuclei, and that these nuclei can be very energetic. Now, in this case, there may be as many as 100 million equivalents, the mass equivalent of 100 million suns, right in the center there, but all confined in a diameter of about 50 light years. There's some conjecture about the exact mass, but we certainly know what the dimensions are. Now, while in the case of this galaxy, it doesn't appear to be particularly energetic at the moment, we do detect galaxies, such as this one, in which the nucleus is extremely energetic in terms of radiation, both at radio and infrared frequencies. And not only do we find them in galaxies of the flat type, which I've just shown you, the spiral type, we find them in these more spherical systems. Here is a system which is a very massive galaxy, which is almost spherical, and which you can see a lot of bright objects around it, which happen to be globular clusters associated with it. This is a very bright radio source, and when we take the equivalent of a snapshot, we find that at its center, it has a bright nucleus and a very energetic jet of material, which looks like something which has been ejected from the center with enormous energy. In surveying for radio sources, it was found that certain objects looked just like stars when they were photographed. That is, the first radio stars appeared to have been found. That is, they were very bright at radio frequencies, but they were almost point-like in their dimensions on photographs. And here's a photograph of a celebrated one, which just happens to have a number, which is 3C273, which is the radio catalog number. And when it was looked at, this is a star-like image. It looks extended here, but this is just spread in the photographic process. We found, in addition, a bright jet associated with it. And this was the dawn of the quasar, or the quasi-stellar object. We now discover a large number of these in the sky, and they have everything in common with the nuclei of galaxies, except that they are very much more energetic, and we detect them out to extremely great distances from us. Probably the most distant one is about 1,000 million light years away from us. And since some theories suggest that the age of the universe is something like 10,000 million light years, we've obviously looked something like 10% of the way back in history when we see these objects. Exactly what is the energy source for these objects, we don't know. But certainly they must be consuming or putting out energy at a terrific rate. their mass equivalent for the consumption of energy is the whole Earth itself per second. If you remember, my analogy for mankind was the equivalent of a tap dripping very slowly. The sun is about 4 million tons, I suppose, about the mass of this building, or somewhat less, whereas these objects may be consuming it at the rate of the whole Earth itself. Now, it's possible that the energy production is through something related to the supernova phenomenon, or even more exotically, to black holes. Let's consider first supernovae. Here's a series of slides, or photographs, taken on the dates you see at the bottom there, in one case a year apart, in the next case about 3.5 years, of a star-like object which appeared in an external galaxy, which was so bright at one point that one could have an exposure which was short enough that you can barely see anything of the underlying galaxy. The next year it was still bright enough to see, and we see something of the underlying galaxy because the exposure was necessarily longer. You can see the exposure times here, 20 minutes, 45 minutes, 85 minutes, and in this case it's effectively disappeared. That means that one star becomes as bright as a whole galaxy for periods of the order of a year. It's a very catastrophic event and appears to be something which happens with extremely massive stars. They burn up their nuclear fuel, assuming that there are nuclear reactions going on, and at some stage they collapse very catastrophically. We're fairly sure that this is what happens because we have evidence of the remnants of these objects in our own galaxy. This is the famous Crab Nebula, which we know was observed as a supernova in about the year 1054. And the material which was flung off at that time has now expanded to the extent that we can see it in these rapidly expanding glowing filaments of gas, together, in fact, with an underlying, if I can be technical for a moment, plasma, which is emitting something called synchrotron radiation. It's a very bright radio source. It's bright in everything from X-rays right through to the radio spectrum. And of course the question arises, well, what is left over? If there is a supernova explosion, there must be some remnant. And it was clear that one of these two stars here must be the remnant. And then there was the very dramatic discovery, again by the radio astronomers, of the pulsars. And the pulsars were pulsating sources discovered in the sky, which pulsated on anywhere between 30 times per second and once every 3 or 4 seconds. And quite a large number of them have been discovered. In fact, the total number now is about 150. And one of the pulsars was found to be one of these stars in the center here, which in fact is pulsating at approximately 30 times per second. Now, the pulsations are extremely well marked, and in fact, in this case, this is a unique case in which we see the pulsations both optically and in X-rays. None of the other sources have been detected visibly. Now, we find most of these pulsars in the positions of supernova remnants, and so we tend to associate them with those. Now, it's possible to do some fairly incisive physics on such things based on the observations, and I'm certainly not going to go into all the deductions except to provide you with the next shot, which shows you a pulsar, which in this case looks surprisingly like a ping pong ball, and gives you some idea of what we think the dimensions of these objects are. About 15 kilometers in diameter, and that is roughly the scale I've shown there relative to the city of Vancouver. but they must be about the same mass as the Sun. This means an incredible concentration from the normal standards of concentration of material. In fact, a concentration down to nuclear dimensions, in which we're dealing with an object which is the same density as the nucleus of an atom. Probably, as you know, any atom consists of a nucleus of heavy particles around which there is a cloud of electrons which circulate. And if this room were to be the volume of an atom, that is, the electrons circulating around the nucleus, then the nucleus would be something like a pinhead in the center of this room. Consequently, it's certainly possible to compact matter to nuclear dimensions, assuming that one has the energy to do so, and a supernova explosion appears to provide this energy. If you would like to think of the size of the Earth at the density of the pulsar, then it would fit into this room. 1 teaspoonful would weigh about 1,000 million tons. However, this is not the end. It's possible to write down on paper at least what might happen if one could compress an object even further, particularly a more massive object. One might end up with the celebrated black hole, in which material is so closely compacted that its gravitational field is too extreme to permit light to escape, and it collapses in on itself effectively, and all we are left with is the effect of its mass and a few other parameters, but we can't see it. It can't emit any light towards us. Now, this was always a possibility on paper, but when the X-ray satellite Uhuru was first put into orbit to look for X-ray sources in the sky, apart from very bright sources like the Crab Nebula, it found a number of weak sources which were associated with very massive stars, ones we could see. But these, in particular, one massive star appeared to be going around another star which wasn't there. At least 50% of the stars in the sky are in double systems, binary systems, with both stars circulating around the center of mass. It's possible for us to derive an orbit even just by having a view of one of the stars. But in this particular case, and I won't go into any more detail, it appeared as if there was nothing at the position, say, of star B, but the equivalent of about something between 10 and 15 times the mass of the Sun. And it appears as if this may be a case in which we have a black hole in orbit around a star. And, of course, we will only see black holes when they interact with matter, and the best case is in a binary star. I can't show you a slide of a black hole. That's against the definition. I'd like to consider just one more highlight, fit this in before I say a little about some of the instruments. And this is not in the last stages of stellar evolution where stars blow up, but in the initial stages, which are probably still not well understood, in which stars appear to be forming out of the gases and dust which make up about half the mass of our own galaxy. This is the well-known emission nebula in Orion. The four stars which are in the center of the sword of Orion are in here. And on this color photograph, you can see the hydrogen gas in the region, which is fluorescing because of the ultraviolet light associated with the bright blue stars, these ones in particular, some overlying smog, really, which is we call interstellar dust. And throughout the region, there are some red stars, which appear to have formed quite recently. And in particular, in the infrared part of the spectrum, we can detect what appear to be protostars, stars which formed very recently, or I should say are in the process of forming. They are rather extended objects, and there is nothing we can see except at infrared wavelengths. But in these directions, and in particular in the direction of the galactic center, first of all, I'll show you one more example, we find that at microwave frequencies, that's very short radio wavelengths, that we can detect the emission lines of a very large number of molecules, and some of them are quite complex, and in much larger numbers than we would have expected. For instance, and I'm taking one at random, you can see in this region where stars are forming, these bright stars are quite new and young, we see the glow of the red hydrogen gas, and we also detect one or two clouds which are silhouetted against the background. And many of these dark clouds appear to contain concentrations of these complex molecules, which have possibly formed in association with the dust grains. Now, in case there are any chemists in the audience, my colleagues in the physics department have kindly supplied me with this listing of the 35 known molecules which have been detected to date. And if you look, they're divided into two parts, the inorganic and the organic. And here we see a collection, the sort of collection we might expect based on the abundant elements in the universe. But on the right, we have the organic, based on carbon, of course, and we see a very extensive list, which is already getting up to a 9-atom complexity, and which contains a large number of those basic units which one would like to start with if one is to go on to the synthesis of more complex molecules and primitive microorganisms. Let me say something about the instruments associated. First of all, in relation to what I've just said, here's the microwave telescope, which is on campus here, and which has been and will be used further to study this, the problems and the concentrations of these molecules in space. The radio telescopes have obviously supplied an enormous background of information on which astronomers working in other fields have been able to build. As one example, I was determined to put in a photograph of my own, is the 100-foot Bonn telescope, which was completed recently. Did I say 100 foot? I'm sorry, I meant to say 100 meters. 100 meters from here to here. It's in a small valley which totally dominates, and certainly dominates the building in which the control and so forth is done. This is satisfactory for observations from 2 to 50 centimeters. Bang. Now, the observations from satellites, here's an example of the actually an orbiting solar observatory. I don't have a photograph of the X-ray satellite, which has produced so many provocative results, which have led to so many of our discoveries. But this orbiting solar observatory is rather similar, and it carries X-ray equipment on board. This is one example. Here is the first orbiting astronomical observatory, the first observatory in space which was dedicated entirely to observations for astronomy. It had telescopes at either end, on both parts, both for direct photography and for looking at the individual stars. Many people say, why don't we all get into space research? And I think many of us would like to, but it should be remembered that an experiment of this sort costs the equivalent of probably 10 200-inch telescopes.
projects of this can't be undertaken lightly because, of course, they have a finite lifetime. We're all looking forward to the Large Space Telescope, which may be put up in the late 1980s. Here's a picture of the 200-inch telescope, which I think many of us consider must have been the finest investment in science which was ever made, considering the scientific returns which it has produced since it was put into operation just over 25 years ago. It's still the largest operating telescope in the world, but a large number of telescopes of slightly smaller aperture are now being put up. And I think the example set by the operation and success of the 200 inches has much to do with this. Now, the Canadian astronomers, optical astronomers, have a half share in a telescope which is expected to be completed by about 1978 and which will be erected on Mauna Kea. 42.5% of the expense is being shared by, I should say, 42.5% each between France and Canada, with 15% from the University of Hawaii, or the State of Hawaii, who provide services. The work's being distributed very evenly between the two countries. The telescope mirror is currently being polished over in Victoria. The dome is being built down at New Westminster, for instance. And the telescope itself will be assembled and tested at La Rochelle in France next year. The design looks surprisingly similar to the 200-inch because the latitude of Hawaii, where it will be, is fairly low, 19 degrees. It will be a large horseshoe which will, through which the telescope will be driven. The mirror will be situated here. That's the 3.6-meter mirror. The prime focus is here with a cage in which some observers will be able to carry out observations. And there's this three-point support. Construction has proceeded well. And here is the top of Mauna Kea, for instance, which is a fairly flat area with a number of cinder cones. And I think it's just coincidence that we've chosen sites which look rather like the photographs I've just shown you of Mercury and Mars. I can assure you it seems like it when you're up there. Here's the state of the construction of the building as it was in July. The tripod, which will support the telescope, is here on top of the concrete cylinder, which is hollow and contains laboratories. And the surrounding building steelwork is complete, and in fact the building has gone a stage further than that since. And here's a slightly more a view showing the site as a whole, with the flat area on which the telescope will sit, and in fact the position from which the photographer took the previous shot. I think this is going to provide a very exciting opportunity for us. We're all certainly looking forward to its completion by 1978. Thank you very much.
As usual, we'll have a question period now. I'm sure there are very many questions. Yes, back there.
Yes.
The question is, why Hawaii? Is it because of the clear weather? The quick answer is yes. One looks for a number of features in the site. In particular, the air turbulence above the site must be very low, and this one only achieves where there is a temperature inversion, where the temperature below the site tends to be lower than that above, such that there's no vertical mixing, and also where there has been laminar flow of the air. And Hawaii fulfills these conditions excellently. It's in the trade winds, and there has been no air turbulence generated by surrounding mountains for some distance back. And being in the sea, you have the cooling effect of the sea, which prevents the vertical mixing. In addition, it's probably the best site for infrared observations in the world because it's so high, and above the site, the amount of precipitable water is extremely low. And this will be a particular advantage for observations in the infrared. Are we going to have any particular problem with the possible activity in the area? I can say that the volcano has been officially declared extinct, which is no comfort to us. There are occasional earthquakes, and Mauna Loa does vent, but as you probably know, the venting of the volcanoes in Hawaii is a particularly unviolent thing, since the lava is rather liquid, and as far as I know, it's not considered to present a serious hazard. We shall keep a lookout for cyanogen drifting over them.
These black holes you were talking about, can you tell whether they're round or whether they're disc-shaped like those nebulae?
The black hole itself doesn't have a shape. The material which is falling into it may have a shape. Or if you like, the black hole may have a shape for a very fleeting time just before it becomes a black hole. Now, perhaps the hardest thing to accept is the fact that, apart from the fact that you and I would fall into it, if there were a black hole between you and me, we wouldn't see it, except for the effect of bending of light or our tendency to be attracted to it. But material which is falling towards it would tend to form into a disk. It's a mathematical convenience to get out of an embarrassing observational situation. That's not considered satisfactory by the chairman. There's a continual conflict between the observational people and theoreticians. I think only because we cannot see any effect other than that of mass in this case. Normally, when a star is in a binary system, given certain conditions about its orbit relative to us, we would expect to see it pass in front of the other star. And at that time, it would slightly occult, or if it's brighter, it would actually make the whole thing brighten up slightly. We don't see any effect of that sort. And the object is so massive that we couldn't expect it to be what we call a white dwarf, which is another type of compact star which is similar in size to the Earth, because white dwarf stars can't exist if they exceed about 1.5, possibly 2 solar masses. And this is certainly something in excess of 10 solar masses. The question is, do we know what determines the various atmospheric compositions on the various planets? I don't really feel I could give you a satisfactory answer to that. In the case of the outer planets, certainly it's the primordial composition. But as you know, the Earth itself, the atmosphere, has undergone a series of dramatic changes, going from a reducing to an oxidizing atmosphere. And this also may have happened with some of the other planets. Whether gas has been vented from the interior, or whether material has been intercepted in the form of ice conglomerates, such as comet heads, I'm afraid I have no answer. White dwarfs?
Holes.
Oh, white holes. They're theoretical. Do I know anything about the two planets which have been discovered beyond Pluto? No. I think that's the limit of our information as well. It's what we read in the paper. I don't know if any of my colleagues have anything different. There have, of course, been previous suggestions of planets beyond Pluto. The most celebrated one, which is the most seriously considered one, turned out to be erroneous. Well, this was a section of my talk which I left out because there was not enough time. The question was the expansion of the universe and our observation of it, does this relate to the Big Bang and what happened prior to the Big Bang? I'd obviously have to be brief in my reply. Clearly, the expansion indicates if material is not being continually created within our universe, and that's been one suggestion, then there must have been a period in the past when the universe was more concentrated, and certainly many of us would be prepared to accept that there was a time when the universe was in a very compact state. And at that point, if you like, time zero, there was either an explosion or it was a transition from a previous occasion, a cycle from a previous occasion when the universe had been expanded, had contracted to a small volume, and had bounced out again. So it rather depends on whether, on exactly what dimensions, dimension is a bad term there, but exactly what density the universe had at that time. And immediately prior, could either have been another state of the universe, that is, one in which it was contracting, or it may have been a period for which we can make no useful comments about the physics. Some people emotionally prefer an indefinite period into the past. Some people like the idea of a creation. You can take a choice at the moment. We don't know. The question was, what is outside the limit of the universe? By definition, we can't know.
Do many astronomers question whether the universe is actually expanding now, whether the redshift can be explained perhaps by gravitation bending the light to the point of redshift, gravitation
from the neighborhood of light? Question is the explanation of the expansion of the universe still accepted, or is there some alternative? I think yes, it is. It can be interpreted certainly most easily in terms of what we describe as a Doppler shift, that is, the change in frequency due to motion of the source. Because we see it over such a wide frequency range, we can see it not only in the visible part of the spectrum, but going right through to the radio part of the spectrum. And with the sort of precision we would expect. And any other type of apparent shift in the spectrum probably would not mimic that.
What is the function of the discontent?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your question.
What is the function of the radio disc?
What is the large radio dish used for penticton. Any radio dish has the property that it can be used at a large number of frequencies, unlike an antenna which is laid out on the ground. There's also several large antennae on the ground. And so this has been used for specific studies of various regions, particularly neutral hydrogen in the 21-centimeter line. I couldn't tell you exactly what it's being used for at this moment. I think this lady here has been trying from the beginning. Does our galaxy have a nucleus? Yes, it certainly does, and it's obvious at radio frequencies and far infrared frequencies, and it also appears to be an active nucleus, though not nearly as active as those I showed you. It's more active than the one in that galaxy in Andromeda, the nearby one, and does it appear double? No. It has structure, of course, because we're closer to it. We can see some of the structure in the nuclear region. There are sharp sources, more like star-like sources, and there is also the broader source of, say, something like 50 light years across. Did you want to put your question now? No.
Your question?
What is the name of the astronomer who discovered the pulsars? Was that your question? Hewish, if I've got it correct.
Right. It was a female graduate student, actually.
I don't want to be embroiled in that. Yes, it's true.
Here.
What's the Milky Way with reference to our galaxy?
The Milky Way, what is the Milky Way with reference to our galaxy? The Milky Way is our galaxy. We sit in the plane of our galaxy. I gave you what might be a plan view of our sun in the outer regions of the galaxy, and because we're in it, it's rather like the interior of a cart wheel. So the band of the Milky Way across the night sky is the we're looking into our own galaxy. And if one lived in the southern hemisphere, or if you can look far enough south here, you can see the hub of this, which is the direction towards the center of our galaxy, which is very impressive. Oh, with the 200-inch telescope? I'm sorry, I accepted that it was so well known. It's in California on Mount Palomar, and it's in fact known as the Hale telescope now. Question is, do I believe that life may visit us from other planets and the possibility of travel in excess of the speed of light? Do I believe that it is possible, or would I like to believe in it? The period of revolution of the planets, well, that's directly related, of course, to their distance out from the sun, and the Mercury travels around the sun in something like 88 days. The Earth goes around in 1 year, of course. Mars takes about twice as long. Do you have any particular... Oh... I'm sorry, I would need to look them up. They're well established, anyway.
Richard, you know.
He's off duty.
Could you undertake an explanation of Einstein's relative theory?
which particular one?
Relativity theory.
Could I undertake one? Well, I can see a galaxy of experts out here in front of me. I see no reason why I should have to cope. But it depends whether you're talking about special or general relativity. I'm not about to try and cope with general relativity. Special relativity effectively says, of course, that as you will always measure the velocity of light to be the one value, no matter what source it's coming from. And the implication of this, of course, is that time scales and apparent dimensions will change, for particularly for rapidly moving objects. And this, of course, is really what is happening in the, if you like, with the recession of the galaxies. Although the galaxy may be moving away with a significant fraction of the velocity of light, we measure the light coming from it with the same velocity as a source in the laboratory, for instance. And the only way in which this could be compensated for is in the energy, therefore the energy is all shifted to longer wavelengths.
Would you say something about the relationship between astronomy and astrology?
Does he always ask questions?
Yeah. I
think I'll take a leaf out of your book and say no.
What is the question?
Would I say anything about the connection between astronomy and astrology? Astrology is a science in its own. There are specific rules and regulations which are laid down in which one's future is expected to be influenced by planets, by other heavenly bodies, and it's possible effectively to enter a table and say, well, given this configuration and the time at which you were born, you can then cast a horoscope. I mean, it's a straightforward, there's really no particular magic about it. You're following certain rules. Astronomy is full of magic, like black holes, and as I say, it's an exploration of the mind. I'm sorry, I don't know enough details about the experiment, but as far as I'm aware, that was quite satisfactory, then that the astronauts suffered considerable accelerations and decelerations in their trip. And of course, this would have an attendant effect on any timepieces which they carried with them, what you call a timepiece anyway, any standard of frequency. The sort of experiments one can perform with cosmic rays, if there are certain cosmic rays which are traveling extremely rapidly, of which we know the decay time of the fundamental particle, then such particles will tend to penetrate further because of their velocity before they before we see the decay than we would expect, just because of the relative time effects. But I think there are a multitude of experiments, but I don't feel myself an expert to discuss them here. The question is that being a discipline which involves the mind, can one point currently to anyone of the philosophical and scientific sweep of Arthur Eddington? And you did say current company accepted. I think I'd like to think about that one. I wouldn't like to be quoted in front of such a large group.
Yes, what is the effect of the discovery of particles which travel faster than light? I believe there's tachyons on relativity and astrophysics in general.
Good question. What has been the effect of the discovery of particles which appear to travel faster than the velocity of light, tachyons, and you mentioned something else? First of all, I'm not quite sure about the experimental background you're talking about, and so I'm not really sure that they have been discovered, and I wouldn't like to anticipate the effect.
They haven't been discovered.
No, they haven't been discovered.
Other questions? Gordon, I would like to thank you on behalf of the audience, both for two things, really. You've showed us some of the magic of current astronomy and told us something about the plans here. I think that the last few years in astronomy have been very exciting. There are many new pictures. It's very clear that they raise far more questions than they provide answers, but the pictures are beautiful. And I think that they continue to excite a great number of young people. They answer the following kind of question. You know, many of you wondered, why did Gordon Shrum leave the business world of hydro and go back to directing a planetarium and that sort of thing? I think you can understand now why he chose to do that a few years ago. I think that astronomy has been something that has been strong in Canada for a while. There was a brief period when in British Columbia we had the biggest telescope in the world at the Dominion Observatory in Victoria. We are now again having a very big telescope, and we have some very bright young astronomers here, and I think these will be exciting years at this university for astronomy too. And I think that all of us owe you a debt of gratitude for telling us a bit about the plans and about the present state of astronomy. Thank you.